Jones, and we are continuing to hear Senate Bill 5517, which is the budget bill of the Department of Environmental Quality. And before I begin today, I will draw the committee's attention to a memo that is in each of your places that deals with a new policy that I'm implementing on absences and lateness from the committee. We have the kind services of Ruthie to keep the books on this one, and we will be glad to invoice you, and it's my hope that we'll have a great party at the end of the session paid for from this fund.
Madam Chair, the flaw in your philosophy is that for $10 a week I can have every afternoon off.
Well, is that why you've got $100 out
He's there? He's got a $100 bill out here. He's leaving.
You can pay in advance. That's fine. Mr. Rocco, you have something to pass out to us?
Madam Chair, I've already passed out to members answers to two questions that were asked yesterday for the agency to respond to on underground storage tanks. And so if you have any further questions about that, I'm sure Ms. Halleck would be happy to respond.
We have three special items on the agenda today, and we'll start with a presentation on enforcement and fines. Stephanie, do you want to take it away?
Why don't you just continue, Chair Morgan? You're doing okay with fines.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck, the Director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and to my right is Neil Mullane, who is currently my acting deputy, but has been the administrator in charge of our enforcement program for some years. And to my left is Jeff Bachman, who's a staff person in the enforcement shop, responsible for some of the cases that were asked about previously. And you're getting a handout from Mr. Rocco right now. I'm just going to give a couple of introductory remarks and then turn it over to Neil and to Jeff. Basically, as you know, this discussion is a follow-up to a March 28th discussion in the House Water and Environment Committee, at which time the department was invited to come back and speak about how we do compliance and enforcement, and there was some interest in this committee as well. And so we are providing that follow-up, and also in addition to our general overview on enforcement, some responses on those specific cases that came up in that committee. Compliance and enforcement, as I discussed in my agency overview, is one of the tools that we use in doing our regulatory work. We also do technical assistance. We also provide loans, as I discussed with you. We also do some compliance orders, which are referred to as mutual agreements and orders. Notices of noncompliance, which are not a formal enforcement action, but merely alerting folks that there is a problem. And then, of course, when the need arises, we do assess civil penalties. And there are some cases where there has been criminal enforcement as well. Just as by point of reference, in the year 2000, out of the notices of noncompliance that we sent, only 1 in 10 of those actually goes all the way through the process to a civil penalty. So it's not as if there is an automatic penalty every time any kind of an environmental problem is discovered. And briefly, I just want to be sure you understand the mechanics, although these folks will go into more detail. I talk to you a lot about our field offices, and one of the responsibilities of our field staff is to do inspections and respond to complaints and that kind of field work, which could result in the need for enforcement. What happens then is a field inspector puts together what is referred to as a referral. They put in all the photographs and the case background and all that kind of thing, and that is sent into our centralized enforcement unit, which operates out of my office. And the reason it's set up that way is for what I discussed with you at some length the other day, which is statewide consistency. So we have referrals that come in from our field inspectors throughout the state to the central enforcement staff, of which Jeff is one of the staff members, and they review all of those cases together so that there is some consistent approach to that enforcement review. And I just
so it doesn't matter whether they're air or water or whatever, they all come to the one place.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And then the enforcement staff has a particular expertise in a program, but they all sit in one unit on my floor next to my office. The other point that I wanted to note, and I know there was a lot of interest in this issue because of the penalty action that was taken in northeastern Oregon, and I did point out in my little cover memo to you that there is a difference between enforcement by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and enforcement by the state DEQ. And that enforcement action in northeastern Oregon that had a $50,000 penalty assessed was actually a federal EPA action. And their actions will result in higher penalties than the state's. We do not have as high a penalty matrix as they do, and that has been an issue for EPA over the years. They have commented several times that they believe our penalty matrix actually should be higher. There are others in the state of Oregon who would agree with them and those who would not agree with them. Specific to your request and what we're going to talk about the rest of the day today are in response to the House Water Environment Committee, they ask for specifically for two items. One is how DEQ calculated civil penalties for four specific cases, and secondly, information about the number of mutual agreements and orders that we have used over time. I think there was some concern about we're being in a relationship under an order by the Environmental Quality Commission with the City of Portland and for them to implement their combined sewer control of the combined sewer overflows. We do have attached to your packet a list of all the mutual agreements and orders that we have entered into with both this is from 1998 until the present, with both government entities, that would be municipalities, and with businesses. So you can see that this is a tool that the department uses relatively broadly. It wasn't just a special kind of thing that we set up for the City of Portland. It is one of our enforcement tools. And what I would like to do now is I'm going to ask Neil Mullane, who, and both of these folks will introduce themselves for the record, to go over with you a couple of the attachments here, just generally how the enforcement process and penalty assessment works, and then Jeff is going to address for you the four specific cases that the committee asked about.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Neil Mullane. I'm the current interim deputy director at DEQ, and if you flip to the second page of the material that we handed out, I'm going to go through very briefly the outline of the process that we use in terms of penalty assessment. And then what we thought is if we go through each one of those four cases through this process, we can show how it actually works in the real world and how we actually go about doing those assessments. As Stephanie has mentioned, the process is really initiated by the documentation of a violation in the field. And then those field violations are then identified in a notice of noncompliance is written and sent to the offending party. And then
when the determination is made that there's a violation, is there a standard set of criteria that have to be documented? I'm just curious how you actually maintain standardization that you have the documentation that a violation has occurred.
Okay. Chair Morgan, members of the committee, in looking at each one of the programs have a series of administrative rules that identify what a particular, say, permittee needs to do for their permit. And that permit would contain a number of different conditions or limitations. So as they document violations, they're looking at whether or not that particular permittee has violated their permit and what provision of the permit they have violated. So that goes directly to a document that that particular person, that source, has, and whether or not he's followed that document, whether or not they fulfilled the conditions of that permit, and whether or not they violate that. It could be a date, whether or not they finished a particular, say, assessment of a engineering design on time, or whether or not they exceeded a particular limit for a a particular pollutant within their permit, where they went beyond the limit that was established in the permit. So the field inspector is collecting information to determine whether or not they were in compliance with that particular permit.
So is the inspector relying on log information from the facility or doing his own testing, or how does he?
Madam Chair, both. I mean, in many of the facilities, they are required to submit to the department monthly reports that show what they've monitored over that particular month. And the inspector would go through that particular report and identify whether they were within their compliance program for that particular facility by looking at that report. And they also then visit the facilities and walk around the facilities and take a look at whether or not the facility is meeting the compliance program at that particular facility.
So if we asked you to bring the file that dealt with the four cases that we asked you to look into, there would be some kind of documentation in there that quantifies the exceedances or the deficiencies?
We'll get into that in a moment as we go through it, because we actually brought part of that file for each one of these so we could go through it with you. Okay, to get back to how the process works is, as those inspectors document those violations, they then prepare a referral to the enforcement section. That is, they put together all the information that they have on those particular violations, all the facts, and they submit that to the enforcement section. Upon arriving at the enforcement section, is assigned to an ELS, and that's one of the reasons why environmental law specialist. And that's one reason why Jeff is here today, because he is one. And we wanted to show you how we go through that process, and he's been doing that for a number of years in reviewing that information as it comes in from the regions and those referrals, and how he goes through the process of identifying those classes, those magnitudes, and each of the other factors. Okay, the first step in that calculation process is really to identify the class of violation. And I kind of struggled with how to give a practical explanation of this, so bear with me for a minute. Is if you think of traffic violations, you have a number of different types of traffic violations. You have different moving violations, turning from the wrong lane, making U-turns, speeding violations, and maybe even as far as vehicular homicide. And as you look at those are all different classes of traffic violations. And in the department, we've sat down in each one of our programs, air, water, hazardous waste, solid waste, we've gone through by rule and identified the various classes of violations on the rules that we have in the department. So if you're in the water program and you have a violation, you can look into those rules and see where the descriptions are in each one of those classifications to determine what class you have violated, where that violation sits within those classifications.
So is it based on the volume of material that is?
The magnitude would be at the volume. But say, for example, back to my traffic example, is that there are more serious violations of the rules. For example, discharging without a permit is a serious Class 1 violation. But if you had missed a report by a day or two, is less serious, significant violation, different class. So we classify those differently because they don't have the same magnitude in terms of a violation or significance as a violation.
Okay.
And then what we do is, once we have identified the class that violation is, we go through again to the rules and identify the magnitude of that violation. For example, back to the traffic one, if you have a speeding ticket, you look to see how many miles over the particular posted speeding limit there was, and then the traffic ticket increases based on the over that particular speeding. So if you look at the magnitude, the ELS, or the environmental law specialist, will sit there and examine the file and determine how much the violation was over the specific criteria that was established. For example, if you have a permit in water program where you establish a specific limit for that plant to meet and not violate, and they violate that limit, if it's chlorine or bacteria or whatnot, you look to see how far over that limit they actually violated that particular limit. And based on that, you would establish the magnitude or select the magnitude for that particular violation. Now, using those two, the class and the magnitude, you go to the established matrix within the rules, and you can identify specifically the base penalty. The base penalty is simply a matrix that goes the classification of that violation across is the magnitudes. You just select that particular base penalty. At that point in time, then, you can go down through and look at the various factors that may aggravate that particular penalty or may mitigate that particular penalty. And I've listed those out here. The first one of those is the what we call the P factor, or whether or not the particular facility has a prior significant action. And those prior significant actions are not just any action. Those particular actions are whether or not it was through a court order or a department order that they had a specific prior action. Then we look at the occurrence factor, the O factor. How often this occurred? Did it occur once? Did it occur several times and over several days? We then look at what the R factor, which really gets to whether or not it was a negligent or an intentional or purposeful type of action. And finally is the cooperativeness. And in this particular outline here, you have both whether or not a particular party was cooperative and that is uncooperative and we aggravated the penalty. And if you look a little bit further, we also have a C for whether or not they were cooperative. And therefore, we would mitigate part of the penalty if, in fact, the particular party was cooperative with us. And then finally, in terms of mitigation, we look at the history of correcting problems once they're identified. If a particular facility in the past has had other violations and we identify those and they quickly took care of those particular violations, we use that as a mitigating factor in whether or not we mitigate that particular penalty. And then finally, once you have the base penalty and you have gone through those particular mitigating factors, you can also, and the department can also add to that what is known as the economic benefit. That is looking at whether or not the particular facility actually had an economic benefit from the particular action that they took. For example, if in fact the particular facility was to have shipped their waste off to a hazardous waste facility and the cost of that was, just as an example, $40 a ton, and instead they shipped it off to a solid waste facility at $20 a ton. Well, there was a $20 economic benefit for them for not properly handling their waste. Therefore, we look at how much a particular violation and that particular facility may have saved by the violation, and we add that as economic benefit. And the purpose of doing this is really to level the playing field so that people violating and actually gaining some economic benefit from that are not really in an undue competitive advantage of other people within their particular sector. And we try to get that particular penalty so that everybody is basically paying within that particular sector the same thing for coming into compliance with the environmental laws. And now what I'd like to do is we were asked to look at four specific cases, and Jeff is going to run down through those particular cases. And actually, what we've attached here are the actual sheets that we use in the department to go through and actually calculate those penalties. And Jeff is familiar with these cases, and he'll give you a background and a rundown through these for you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bachman. I am an environmental law specialist in the Office of Compliance and Enforcement with DEQ. I think it would be very helpful for the committee if, in your packets, if you could turn to the pages that look like these exhibit sheets, Exhibit 1, and the first one we're going to talk about is City of Portland. And as Mr. Mullane referred, these exhibits are what we use to calculate the civil penalties, and these are actually attached to the notices which go to the respondents in the civil penalty cases. So, when a facility or an individual receives a civil penalty, they actually get one of these exhibits, and so they can follow along. They also get a copy of our rules. So they can sort of follow along and figure out how we got to where we got on the civil penalty. If you look at the first penalty, which is the City of Portland, this covered several incidents, this particular case. In March of 1999 at the city's Columbia Boulevard sewage treatment plant, a defective vacuum regulating valve in the city's chlorination system, or the treatment plant's chlorination system, failed. And that released poisonous chlorine gas into the control room for the chlorination system. The city then shut down the chlorination system and evacuated the room until the chlorine levels fell down to safe levels for people to re-enter that space. During that shutdown period, there was no chlorination of the effluent that the plant was generating. The chlorination is the last step in the treatment process. It's a final disinfection before the wastewater is actually discharged to the receiving stream. So they had one incident, and it was shut down for about 7 hours at that point. 3 days later, they were trying to figure out where the leak had come from, trying to isolate the leak, and they hit the bad valve. When they removed the bad valve, there was still chlorine trapped in the pipe. They had another release of chlorine gas. They again had to evacuate, shut down. And again, they had a period, I think this time was a much shorter period, during which there was, again, no chlorination of the plant's effluent. As a result of these two leaks, they had about 42 million gallons of effluent, mostly treated effluent, which hadn't gone undergone final disinfection, discharged to the river. On the third violation that was covered in this case, they had another problem with the chlorination system. They were doing regular maintenance, and they had taken the power down to the chlorination system, and then the backup generator failed. And they didn't discover the failure until about 20 minutes into it, at which point they replaced the power source, but they had another 750,000 gallons of undisinfected sewage that then was again discharged to the river. Now, in this, if you go at look at Exhibit 1, that covers the first two violations, which was the chlorine gas leak. And if you look again, violation number 1 describes the specific statute which was violated, and there's actually a typo on that should be 468B0501A, not 10A. And then, as Mr. Mullane described, the first thing we look at is the classification. Here, you look to Division 12, the enforcement rules, and that will tell you that this particular violation is a Class 1 violation. You then look to the magnitudes, the next step, and in this particular instance, we have two types of, there's two ways to determine the magnitude. One is selected magnitudes, which is very specific. It says, if you exceed your permit limit by this much, then you're going to have this particular magnitude. For some violations, because the variance can be so great, there is no selective magnitude. And in those instances, there's one of three things the department can do. If it has enough information that says that there was no harm or no potential for harm from the violation, then the department finds that it's a minor magnitude. On the alternative, if it finds that there was either significant harm or a significant chance of harm from the violation, it gets elevated to a major magnitude. If you don't have enough information to make either of those findings, then by default it becomes a moderate magnitude. And that's what happened in this particular case. We did not have enough information to prove that there was no harm, and we didn't have enough information to prove there was major environmental harm.
What's harm? How do you define harm?
It's actually, Neil, do you have that copy of Division 12?
Madam Chair.
President of Hayden.
I have the same question. What is harm or what is pollution? Is the same agency defining harm and pollution as is assessing penalties for fine and pollution? Who's defining what the damage is?
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, the statute actually 468B050 defines pollution. And that's the definition that we apply in determining whether or not pollution has occurred. But if in making this determination, whether when there is no selected magnitude, whether it should be minor, moderate, or major, the Division 12 rules actually set forth some factors the department is supposed to look at. So, for example, it says here, and this is in OAR 340.012-0045, in making a determination of minor magnitude, the department shall consider all available applicable information, including such factors as the degree of deviation from the commission's and the department's statutes, rules, standards, permits, or orders, the concentration, volume, percentage, duration, toxicity, and the extent of the effects of the violation. And then again, that same language is also repeated for a finding of a major violation.
Senator Dukes.
Periodically, the combined sewage overflow of the city of Portland results in raw sewage being dumped into the Columbia. Are they fined for that?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, the city of Portland has entered into a stipulated agreement with the department. And under that agreement, if they're within the levels that are established within that agreement, they're not fined for those discharges. Okay.
So in this case, they're fined because of some accidents that happen, and they get to get basically chewed up by a state agency because a valve was faulty, which I am assuming they were doing regular maintenance and wouldn't have known that. And yes, they dump sewage and or untreated effluent, and that's not a good thing, but I mean, it's not like they were doing something that would have led them to believe this was going to happen. With the sewage overflow, they've got something like a 20-year plan to clean up their system, and they know, we know, that every so often we will dump untreated raw sewage into the Columbia River. And we don't fine them for that? But we fine them when they have an accident. I don't get it.
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, let me please respond to that. Neil knows more about the combined sewer overflow agreement. However, for those violations which don't come under that agreement, which come to us, you know, one of the things that we look at in determining, and it's one of the factors in the civil penalty calculation, is what caused the accident or the violation. In this particular case, we determined that the city was negligent. And the basis for that negligence was the fact that, in addition to they have a primary chlorination system. Let me just back up for a second. All treatment plants are supposed to have redundant capability. So if something goes wrong, there's a backup system which will kick in until they can fix the problem. In the city's case, they had a primary chlorination system. They had a backup chlorination system. However, they had both the primary and the backup systems were in the same place. So when they had a leak like this, they couldn't reach the primary or the backup system, so they really didn't have a truly redundant system.
So tell me how that differs from the combined sewage overflow, which clearly must not have a backup system, or it wouldn't be dumping raw sewage into the Columbia River. I'm just trying to make these two come out even. In the one case, it seems to me that they truly had a mechanical error, and we're going to send them paperwork, and we're going to fine them. In the other, we simply tell people to stop fishing and swimming in the river because it's so bad. But that's okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, members of the committee, I think you have to look at the history of the water quality program to get an answer for that. And that is, when the city of Portland began to construct its sewer system, it was the standard, you know, engineering practice to combine both the sewage and the stormwater runoff. And they did that for many, many years.
When the city of Astoria was built, it was accepted practice to just run your lines out into the Columbia River, but we don't let them do that anymore.
Well, the city of Astoria also has a combined system, and they're also under an order from the department to address that particular situation. And we, under that particular order, also allow them to discharge until they meet their compliance with their schedule in the city of Astoria. But what has happened is, as the laws changed, we now don't allow that nationally to occur anymore. And so the facilities that were built and designed, you know, in the 30s and 40s now have to change those particular designs and come into compliance. And as we look at the various, I think there was 31 of those types of facilities about 10 years ago in Oregon, and we looked at those facilities, we put them on compliance orders, we put them on, you know, specific deadlines to come into compliance. And as with all those other facilities, all the 30 facilities, Portland was put on a schedule for 20 years to design and remove on an incremental process the discharges from their particular combined system. And as we move through time, they complete elements of that process, that is, that design. They've completed their work on the Columbia Slough. They're in compliance in the Columbia Slough. They've taken care of all the discharges of the Columbia Slough. They're now working on the west side of Portland. And they're moving through all the piping systems on the west side. And
I know they're working hard, and I know they put an incredible amount of money into the system, and we'll put a lot more into it before it's finished. I guess if we're truly looking at clean water in the state of Oregon, I don't understand how, as a state agency, we can say, we know you're going to dump X amount of raw sewage into the major river in the state, and that's okay, because you're working on it. But then again, when they have what is a mechanical problem, that's not nearly as major as some of these other spills, that's okay. From a clean water thing, I've never understood how it is we can say, you can pollute for the next 20 years, but as long as you're working on it, it's okay.
Madam Chair and Senator Dukes, if I could just interject, I think in this particular case, it's important to understand the difference between the two situations. Because in to a certain extent, it's a little bit of apples and oranges. The violation in the case that Jeff was talking about relates to a facility operated by the City of Portland that has a permit. And the recent spill at the other pump station, I can't remember which one it was, that happened in the last month or so, was also dry weather pump station permitted facility. And when they are issued that permit to operate that facility by the department, that permit, as Neil said, has a bunch of conditions in it that they need to meet. And so when an event happens for whatever reason and that permit gets violated, that's what the enforcement action that Jeff's been talking about is taken in response to, are the violations of the permit conditions, which is a separate kind of a regulatory mechanism than the order scenario that the city is under and several other municipalities are under, the list that I attached to this handout, where you have a big dollar long-term project that a municipality in particular may not have the resources to invest in all at once, but you put them basically on a compliance schedule to get that done over time. And so that's the difference between the two scenarios that we're talking about.
And apparently it seems equitable to you. It doesn't to me. The one over which they seem to have a little control, they get fined for, and the one over which they have more control, and quite honestly, I don't understand why the state of Oregon isn't, in order to have better, more clean water, isn't investing more in cleaning up the Portland, or advancing the Portland system so that they're finally... they're in compliance a lot sooner. I'm amazed, given all the things that we care about in that river, that we're not trying to do that, and in the Willamette as well. But it seems inequitable to me, Madam Chair, that on the one hand we say it's okay when we know it's going to happen, and on the other hand, when it's an accident, we say we're going to fine you.
I don't think you're the only one that's asking that question.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nolan.
If I might, 2 points. I think we need to clarify, and people at the department, I think, made the clarification, but I'm not sure it rang true. Just so we understand, the combined sewer overflows in the City of Portland's system do not go to the Columbia River. They don't any longer go to the Columbia Slough. That part of that consent decree has been fulfilled completely, if I understand correctly. The discharge points now still functioning the way they were designed to function are to the Willamette River. And I'd also suggest that it isn't simply a matter of giving the respondent, the City of Portland, the time to raise the money. This is a massive public works project that overwhelms the construction business in the metropolitan area. And there, frankly, aren't contractors enough in the state of Oregon to do the entire project on much faster of a schedule. And while it certainly ought to be done as quickly as possible, you can't force things to go faster than there are people available to design the pipes and put them in the ground.
Representative Krieger.
Chair Morgan, we're talking about the 20 years that they've got to get it done. We're not talking about the 30 years that they've known they've had a problem. That's 50 years. The other thing is, I come from the forestry background. I don't know anywhere that I can get a permit to remain out of compliance for any length of time in forestry. You can't do it in agriculture. I can guarantee if you're a commercial fisherman, you're not going to be allowed to be out of compliance for a day before NIPS is going to have you by the heels. Now, I sympathize with Portland, but I get to thinking recently in our ag and timber the CAFO bill you had today, where a farmer gets paid, fined $50,000 for it's like a drop of water in the ocean compared to what Portland's doing. He gets fined $50,000, so let's compare that to what Portland's paying. And as far as having enough contractors, I'm quite sure if you put out the bids, you get contractors from outside of Oregon to to handle it quite ably. I think we could probably beat this thing to death. No one likes it. I don't think you like it. But it leaves a sour taste in people's mouth around the state when you see some small little city get a fine for 5,000 gallons or whatever it might be. And it seems like it's an improportional compared to probably the damage that's being done in the Columbia. And then you got the endangered species and you got the Oregon plan. We all need to be working together to find some money, make sure it gets done. That's the ultimate goal in my mind.
Let's center back on the presentation, because the question that was asked in the Water and Environment Committee was, is there really equity in the way that the enforcement is done? And so that's what we're trying to get a picture of here. So would you permit me, Representative Hansen, to continue with the presentation?
Certainly.
Madam Chair, I believe we were discussing magnitude, and that's kind of where some of the other discussion came in. I did explain how we reached the magnitude in this particular case. And as Mr. Mullane explained, you take that magnitude, you take that class, and you go to a matrix, which is also in our rules, and that gives you the base penalty. If you look at this form, where it's a civil penalty formula, it actually sets forth the calculation on how we include the base penalty and then the aggravating and mitigating factors. For this particular case, the base penalty by matrix is $3,000. Then we look at the prior significant actions. These are violations which have been established either by a court order or an order of the Environmental Quality Commission. And if you look here, maybe I should back up for 1 second. When we get these values, there's values here for P, which is 6, and H, which is minus 2. Those numbers are times 10% of the penalty. So, for example, here on the P, it's a 6, the 10% of the base penalty, I should say, which is $300. So that 6 is going to result in an $1,800 increase in the penalty. And here, as we said, that because of their prior significant actions, by rule, it tells us that's a 6. We then go down to the H factor, which is the history that in this case, the City of Portland, took to correct their prior significant actions or prior violations. That's a minus 2. O is whether or not the violation was a single occurrence or was repeated. Here, we assess penalties for both violations. A lot of times, the department will assess just one penalty for multiple violations, and that's when this O factor comes in. It reflects the fact that it was a continuous or repeated violation, and they get a small aggravating factor for that. But here, it's a 0 because we did, in fact, assess separate penalties for both violations. R is what we would call the causation factor. Was it caused by negligence, intentional conduct, flagrant conduct, or an unavoidable accident?
So just for a point of clarification, there was 2 spills, so there were 2 of these documents generated. Is that what you're saying?
Or is it next page?
Actually, no, Madam Chair. If you look at this at the second page of this, or the opposite side, you have a total civil penalty that's calculated out. Then there's a sentence at the bottom which says that the respondent was assessed penalties for both the March and 6th and 9th violations. And so you take that $4,800 and times it by 2.
Thank you.
Returning to the factors, the R is the cause of the violation here, because we felt that this particular chlorination facility was built in 1992. So it's a fairly new facility. We felt that it was a design, it was a matter of negligence. They didn't actually provide true redundancy, because if they had a leak like this, they couldn't get to the backup controls. So they really didn't have a redundant system. So we gave them the 2 aggravating factor for negligence. As far as the C factor, which is the cooperativeness factor, and whether or not they corrected the violation or took efforts to prevent the violation from recurring, we gave them a value of 0, because once the sewage was gone, it was gone. There wasn't really anything that they could do to correct it. So that's sort of a null factor.
So correcting the violation is removing the pollution rather than fixing the problem that caused the pollution to escape?
It depends, Madam Chair. It can be. There's really 3 things we look at. One is actually correcting the violation, which I think... Yeah, turning it off. The second one would be what we would call taking reasonable efforts to minimize the environmental harm caused by the violation. For example, if you have a sewage truck that spills and you can actually get another pumper out there to suck some of the stuff up before it gets into the water, they would get a cooperativeness credit for that. And the third is taking extraordinary efforts to prevent a recurrence of the violation. So if you implement for a company that generates hazardous waste, if they implement an environmental management system, which is not required by statute, but which will help them do a much better job of keeping track of their hazardous waste, that would be an extraordinary effort to prevent a violation from recurring, so they would get a credit for that.
Senator Dukes, right?
Does DEQ issue permits for these facilities when they're built?
Yes.
You do?
Senator Dukes, Madam Chair, yes, they do.
How is it you didn't notice they didn't have a completely redundant system?
Madam Chair, we have an engineer, and Senator Dukes, we have a professional engineer on staff. The facilities, when they are making major changes to their facilities, are required to submit their plans for plan review and approval. However, that plan review and approval is not a guarantee or is not a stamp of approval against all future occurrences that might occur. We just don't. We have one engineer who covers six counties in what we call the Northwest region of Oregon, which would be Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, Clatsop, Columbia, out to the coast, and he has to review all the plans. So he obviously can't give the level of detail and attention that a paid consultant who's actually designing the facility for a city or an industry or civil or elsewhere would have.
Have you ever asked for in your budget for the funds for another engineer?
Madam Chair, I don't know that anybody at this table could answer that question for the past. In this budget request, there are positions in the water quality package 121, I think it is, which are associated with the water quality permit fee increase. Those are all positions located in the field associated with the permitting program, and that would include positions to do this kind of work that Jeff is talking about.
I just would have thought that if we give you a permit, that would carry some indication that we thought your plan was a responsible plan, and then we turn around and find you later because it wasn't responsible enough, I guess.
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, I think that is an excellent observation and absolutely correct. And I think that it ties into an sort of a related discussion that we have at the department, and I'm sure you might have heard about in the context of receipts authority, and that's the degree to which the department does the actual overview and stamp of approval on materials, whether they're designs or whatever they are, versus having a consultant in this case or whomever submit designs and maybe not having the actual stamp, but just reviewing and saying, well, it comes from a reputable consultant that we're used to dealing with and they're probably okay. And just because of workload, maybe that one little thing in the corner didn't get looked at. I think it's a good point. It's something we've talked about a lot there, because we are, particularly in the water program, chronically short-staffed, and sometimes these things happen. And I think it's a point well taken.
Chair. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have a sense, any of you, how much of these issues occur on opening day of a plant as compared with as that plant operates for 5 years, or you renew, and then 10 years, and maybe you're 15 years into operating that plant, and the city it's designed to serve might have gone through the explosion of population some cities in the 90s have gone through and are now serving considerably more population. How much of it is because the original design wasn't sufficient to what it was designed for, and how much of it is because the audience being served has changed either in volume or toxicity level or something like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, that's an excellent question. We don't have in the department, you know, the history and keep track of that type of information where you would look at and keep in a database those types of answers. Though I think if you look at, you know, just anecdotally, the types of things that we see in terms of violation, obviously when a plant first opens, there are oftentimes engineering flaws here and there where, you know, although it was designed correctly and you reviewed it and you had it stamped by an engineer, when you open it up and the water and the sewage start coming to it, there are little glitches here and there depending on how one particular piping system was put in or not put in. And over time, you work those particular glitches out and you're working and the plant operates usually fairly well for a period of time. But then as both the types of customers you have in a facility might change, you get different types of pollutants coming into that facility, you have time in terms of whether or not the equipment wears down or wears out, you have glitches as you go along in particular facilities. And the older they get, if the operation maintenance isn't maintained, you wind up with more and more glitches and more problems. I mean, the equipment wears out and you have problems. And then you wind up having facilities that operated early when they were first new with very low volumes of sewage coming to them, and they were very efficient and they worked very well. And as you get to the end of the life of that particular facility, it's meeting its capacity right up near the edge, they have a little bit more difficulty because you're right there where the ability of the plant is to, you know, treat that particular way. So you do wind up having, you know, more problems, and you start to look at those particular facilities, you know, in terms of 10, 20, 30 years as to whether those problems will occur.
Follow up, if I may.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'm looking at some of the detail of what you've handed out and some of the other, what you're calling the MAO summary. And I don't mean to put you on the spot with this, and I understand that there are a lot of things listed here, but a couple of these jump out, and I'd like if maybe one of you knows some of the specifics, perhaps. The city of Jervis cannot meet existing limitations with existing facility. What are we, are they under a consent decree? Do they have time to resolve that? City of Newport, insufficient hydraulic capacity during high flow conditions. We don't just put a cork in it, do we? What kind of workout arrangement do you have with some of these others? EBO, sanitary authority, exceeds permit limits during high flow conditions. Can you address one or some of those in terms of how you handle it if you have a condition that's ongoing that can't be met? How do you respond?
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, Neil can get into more detail, but basically that's what an MAO is. It's a mutual agreement and order, which is a compliance schedule that gives those folks time to come into compliance with this. In terms of the specifics, I don't know those each individual orders in detail. I don't know if you do or not.
So,
do you know
so but if I might, just so I understand that. So each of these facilities is under a planned
yes.
resolution of the problem and isn't expected with one flip of the valve to suddenly meet compliance or put a cork in it or stop their discharges.
That's correct. Okay. Representative Hayden.
Yeah, to come back to my original question, who sets the fines and then who polices the fines? And you said the fines were by statute. In just the few little references I've looked at here, it seems like the agency has a lot of discretion, and it says in 468.130, that the fines are set by rule, that the legislature has allowed the agency to set by rule. The agency didn't set the fines, except they did have some caps. There's an occasional place where they say $10,000 a day is the maximum, but doesn't say any minimum.
Representative Hayden, that's absolutely correct, and I don't recall your earlier question, but I believe there were two parts to it, and we answered the first part as being in statute, and then the second part is being in rule, so maybe we weren't clear. But you're correct. The actual matrix, all the stuff that Jeff is walking you through today is set by rule.
Let me remind the committee, too, that we're halfway through our time allotment, and we're about three pages into the first item on our agenda, so we should keep rolling here.
Madam Chair, I think since we've gotten some of this preliminary stuff through and a level of understanding, some of these will go a lot more quickly. The last factor that we looked at again in the City of Portland case is this EB or economic benefit factor. again, the cause of the violation here, you know, was a defective valve, but also the design problem. In this case, we felt that it would have been very speculative for us to try and estimate what proper engineering or proper consultant would have cost the city or what cost they might have avoided in that particular case. So in this particular case, we elected not to assess any economic benefit at all because, again, we felt it would just be too speculative. So when you flip it over, you actually can plug the numbers in that you develop into the formula, which then, as you do the calculation, you reach the total of $4,800 per violation. And so for these two particular violations, we did $4,800 for each one, so the total penalty for this was $9,600.
And Madam Chair, if I might, I know you want to move along, but I want to make a point here that is relevant to my discussion earlier and all of this. This process, and you'll see this in the rest of these cases, that's the same process that is applied, whether it's the city of Portland or the city of Salem or whatever. It's just what Jeff outlined, and that in response to Representative Krupp's questions the other day, and the difficulty that folks are struggling with about equity, the question really becomes, if, or could become, in this formula that we've set up in this whole elaborate system to ensure consistency and objectivity, should there be factors that are added in here that do weigh size of community or ability to pay or whatever they might be? That's really the essence of the question. I mean, we've gone to great pains in many, many years before my time to come up with an equitable system. And the question really is, ought there to be factors in here that are not necessarily consistent?
Well, I agree with you, and that's what was in my mind. It seems like that these should be maximum penalties, that your formula would determine a maximum penalty that would be applied to the largest corporations or the largest cities. And if it's a very small city or an individual whose septic tank is leaking into a creek, they couldn't pay the same penalty that the city of Portland could, nor should they be asked to. Because the same regulations that allow you to set the fines also allow you to educate, to conciliate, to consult. It gives you a lot of options on what you can do besides fining.
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, that is true. And the system, I don't mean to imply that the system doesn't have any of that built into it, because there is a different penalty structure for whether it's an on-site sewage violation or an open burning. Some of those are much, much, much smaller fines. But when you're getting to the same kind of an operation, whether it's sewage treatment plant here or a sewage treatment plant there or a sewage treatment plant there, it's the same system for everybody, regardless of size, et cetera.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let's step through these because I'm real interested in the River House and how that all figures in. So if we could just kind of keep moving through these, yes. I think we'll kind of develop a perspective on this. Senator.
I wanted to just ask about the issue of moratoriums, because I think that was something that may be in the minds of people in terms of treatment of larger communities relative to smaller communities, when both of them were under a consent agreement. I guess I'd like to ask about
it. Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I was just asking Helen. I didn't bring my copies of the past stuff that I handed out to you, and I don't know if Senator Farioli was here that day, but the question came up in one of our earlier days about moratoriums, and I did respond on Vinita, Brookings. There were four communities. The general answer to that is that a moratorium is a last resort, if you will. And generally what happened, and I think happened in all those communities, is that there had been this process attached here where you have a mutual agreement and order. And you'll notice there's a number of small cities that have those. They would get into a relationship with the department like that. And they would also, in most cases, as I pointed out, get loans from the state revolving fund, or in the old days construction grants program, to come into compliance, to bring their treatment plants into compliance. If for whatever reason they're not able to comply with that mutual agreement and order over time, whether or not they just, and usually it's they don't have the money or they can't get their community to vote the bonds in, then oftentimes, and I indicated in those four communities, there will be a dialogue between the department and the city about whether or not a moratorium is going to be able to get those cities where they need to get in terms of being able to repair their treatment plants. And in many cases, well, in some cases, and I think in the cases that I gave to you, they were successful. When the mechanism of a moratorium was used, they were able to pass the bonds to get the funding to then do the upgrades. So it's not just the department comes in and says, bam, you have to shut down. It is a process that we go through with these mutual agreement and orders, and then when they don't work, that's one of the potential outcomes.
Follow up, Senator.
Just to try to put something in perspective, I think the moratoriums were the things that caused people the most angst over the Department of Environmental Quality's administration of the permitting process. And the thing that we heard constantly was, well, you wouldn't slap a moratorium on Portland. And that's true. But the moratorium was used more as an incent to get the bond measure passed than it was a clean water issue. And so there was a political value to the moratorium, I guess if you could put it in that category. And that also rankled many people because it looks extortionary and it feels extortionary. And in fact, it's a message to the community that you have to comply or you can't have any growth in your community. And it's a tough, you know, it's like castor oil. It's a tough dose to take. And that's the thing that I think has sort of followed the department around, is that approach that is in one sense it's adaptive, because the department and the community get to know each other and have an ongoing relationship, and the relative capacity of the community is something that the department has to gauge when it approaches how do you get compliance with the Clean Water Act. Because standing behind the department with a stick, as we've discovered recently, is the Environmental Protection Agency. They're lots less likely to be amenable to anything that we might do from our Oregon perspective. And that's one of the things that comes up in play again. Portland has negotiated with the Environmental Protection Agency an extension on compliance, and they'd like to negotiate another one. And those of us in rural communities look at that and think, well, why in the hell should we let Portland negotiate an extension on water quality compliance when we've got people literally kicking doors down in cattle and confined animal feeding operations and levying fines and so on and so forth? And the answer is because we may need to also at some point in time negotiate extensions. And so I've come to the rough conclusion that whatever is administratively available to a city or a county or a state in terms of a remedy or a negotiation, we shouldn't close the door on it. And we shouldn't be too quick to walk away from it, because it's that flexibility administered by Oregonians that gets us the greatest compliance over time. It feels like injustice. Sometimes it looks like those that have the most money and the most votes and the most political power can always negotiate a better deal. But the fact is, there isn't a community in Oregon that at some point in time hasn't been caught by an administrative rule or a compliance order that's beyond its capacity to meet. And so, you know, we can scream about justice and we can talk about injustice, but I think we ought to be pragmatic in how we approach resolution on these issues and not just poke somebody in the eye because they apparently got a better deal somewhere. So, you know, I too have been one of those people that has thundered loudly and beat on the table and said, well, if Portland, and then you can fill in the rest of the sentence. And how come we can't, you know, and you can fill in the rest of that sentence too. But the fact of the matter is, as public policy administrators, what we need to do is put the maximum flexibility into the way we get compliance, because no two communities have the same capacity. We only have the same requirement to meet, and that's the Clean Water Act. So that's all I have to add. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, turning to Exhibit 2 from the City of Portland's penalty, this was the second incident where they had the backup power system fail when they were doing maintenance. To Senator Duke's concern, this was an instance where we didn't feel that there was negligence, that there really wasn't anything that the city could have done. So we didn't actually levy a penalty for the fact that they had an unauthorized discharge. However, their permit requires them, when they do have an unauthorized discharge, that they immediately notify the department. And in this case, it was 3 days before they contacted the department and told us that they had had this unauthorized discharge. So violation of this particular permit condition is a Class 1 violation. This is one of these situations where it's a default magnitude. We don't have the information to find that it's a minor violation or a major violation, so we default to the moderate. The base penalty, again, is $3,000. For the prior significant actions, this event occurred almost a year after the other one, so they had, in fact, the city had had another prior significant action in that time. So this value is higher than the previous case. But they got that 7 factor. Again, they got the minus 2 because they on the H factor because they had taken steps to correct their prior violations. Here's this O factor. While the violation continued for 3 days, we did not assess them a penalty for each day that they failed to report. We assessed one penalty, but because it continued for more than one day, this O factor, this occurrence factor, kicks in, and it results in an aggravating factor of 2 or 20% increase, $600 in this case. On the R factor, we felt it was a matter of negligence when our inspector called the city and talked to the responsible official and said, why wasn't this reported within 3 days? Her response was, I'm new, I haven't read the permit that thoroughly yet, or wasn't aware of this particular condition in the permit, that's why we didn't call you for 3 days. We felt that it's a requirement that's expressed in the permit, the city know or should know that it has this reporting requirement, so we aggravated the penalty for negligence. They did in fact call in and correct the violation, the non-report violation, so they got the credit for cooperativeness. And then finally, on the economic benefit, we couldn't figure out what a failing to report, any way that the city received any economic benefit for that. So that was also a 0 factor. And then again, if you flip the page over and you look at the actual calculation that's done, it results in a penalty of $5,100. So when you combine this with the unauthorized discharge violations of $9,600 and this particular action, we fine the city $14,700.
In the first one that we looked at, in the C category, they were given a value of 0, and in this one they were given a value of minus 2. What's the difference there in how that was assessed?
I think, Madam Chair, when we looked at this, usually with discharge violations, because the pollution is already gone and downstream, we don't see it as really as a, I mean, the city can be very cooperative, but since they can't take any action to correct the violation, or in this case didn't take any reasonable efforts to minimize, again, they really didn't have the opportunity because the pollution was already downriver. And they didn't really take any extraordinary steps. I mean, they fixed the problem, but they didn't install any extra equipment or anything at this point. We felt that was a 0. When it's a failure to notify, they actually did notify us. So if I maybe could try it. In the one instance, the violation is complete, it's done, it's already happened with the discharge, and the discharge is sort of a clean event. With the other one, the failure to notify, it's an ongoing violation, it's continuing, so they, in fact, realized that they had the ongoing violation, ceased it, corrected it, notified us. I think that was the distinction that we made.
So is this actually discretionary then? You would be using your discretion to figure out what you were going to do in this category, or is it proscribed by the violation too, how you assign the value here?
Yeah. Madam Chair, in the Division 12 rules, you have 3 choices for this particular factor. And one is that they've been uncooperative and didn't take any efforts to correct the violation. And that, by rule, that's a 2, so that would increase their base penalty by 20%. And then you can have a situation where they were cooperative, but the violation wasn't correctable, such as the city's case. The rules say that's a 0. And then the third thing is that they are cooperative and they took some efforts to correct the violation, or they actually corrected the violation. In that case, the rules say that's a minus two. So
spills would always be a zero in this category?
Not necessarily, Madam Chair. If they had, again, if they had taken some measures, what we would call an extraordinary effort to prevent a recurrence of the violation. So they had installed some new equipment, or they had done, as we would like them to do, install a truly redundant system where they have a separation between their primary and their backup controls. So if they have a leak in one area, it doesn't prevent them from getting to the other set of controls. That would be something that we would consider to be an extraordinary effort to correct or to prevent another violation, in which case they would have gotten the credit.
Thank you.
Okay, moving to the next exhibit, which involved a company called Bionic Brooms, Inc. And the factual background on this case is that on April 18th of 2000, an employee of Bionic Broom disposed of a diluted waste floor stripping chemical, which is known by the name of Sentinel 626 Carpet Adhesive Remover. And they washed this waste floor stripping chemical into a storm sewer in the city of Portland that drains to a tributary of Tryon Creek. Sentinel 626 in its pure form has a pH of 12.4, which is only one tenth of a pH unit from being a hazardous waste. So it's very strong stuff. At the time that this incident occurred, or this particular incident was referred for a civil penalty, and at the time, they were notified that they could not, in fact, dispose of waste in the storm sewers. About a month later, a second incident occurred after this violation had already been referred, where Bionic Broom, an employee of Bionic Broom, emptied out a floor cleaning machine also into a storm drain, which led to a small creek, Kellogg Creek, in the city of Milwaukee, actually. So in this particular case, the department assessed two civil penalties, one for each instance of the violation. And Exhibit 1 would be for the first case, which was, again, the very high pH floor stripping chemical. This is the same class or type of violation, I should say, as the City of Portland's case, which is an unpermitted discharge or unauthorized discharge of waste to waters of the state. And from the City of Portland case, we know that's a Class 1 violation. In this particular case, it was magnitude. The ELS who did this case decided this was he did not have the information to make a finding of minor, nor the information to make the finding of major. So this, again, also defaulted to a moderate. So again, this also parallels the city of Portland. The base penalty is $3,000. This particular company did not have any prior significant actions. So that factor is a zero. The age factor is only a mitigating factor. It can only help a company respond in a civil penalty case if they've had prior violations. It actually cuts down on the P factor. So since there's no P factor here, the age factor is also zero. O is, again, the occurrence of the violation. We were looking, because we were assessing separate penalties for both violations, the O, again, here is a zero. The R factor, which is this causation factor, again, as with the cooperativeness factors, there's four findings the department can make here. One, that it's an unavoidable accident, in which case there's no aggravating factor applied. Two, that it's negligence is the cause, in which case it gets a factor of two. Three, that it's an intentional violation, it was an intentional violation, in which case it's a factor of six. And the fourth option is what's called flagrant conduct. They actually knew what the requirements of the law was. They went out and they consciously committed the violation. And that's a factor of 10, so that actually doubles the base penalty. In this particular case, we felt it was negligence. There was a labeling on the container, the product, which said, you know, you must dispose of this properly. And so in this case, we felt the company knew or should have known that you shouldn't be disposing of floor stripping chemicals into storm sewers, particularly when the product is labeled in that manner. C factor is, again, the cooperativeness factor. Here, the ELS made a determination the violation could not be corrected, even though the respondent was cooperative, so the factor was a zero. And then the final factor, or the final consideration, is the economic benefit. And here, again, we didn't feel like there was sufficient information to make a determination as to what the economic benefit would have been. I mean, it would have been for them to have disposed of this material properly, which probably would have been a very inconsequential cost. So in this case, we decided not to assess an economic benefit. Again, we have the penalty calculation at the bottom, and we plug the numbers into the formula, and they got a penalty of $3,600 for this violation. I should mention at this point that both the City of Portland case that I discussed before and this case have both been appealed by the city and also by Bionic Broom, and the department is in discussions with them on how to resolve the case. So these penalties have been assessed, they've been appealed, so there's nothing final. These penalties may end up being paid at what they've been assessed, or they may end up, we may end up settling the case and the companies may, or the city may pay less. Flipping over to the next page is the penalty we assessed for the second violation. This was the floor washer, which was also emptied into a storm drain. Same violation, so therefore same class. ELS, again, didn't feel there was sufficient information to make a finding of that there was no harm, so that was so there couldn't be a finding of moderate, or excuse me, of minor. And then again, there was no harm of significant environmental harm, or no evidence of significant environmental harm. So it couldn't make a finding of major. The magnitude was moderate. I'll kind of skip down because a lot of these factors are the same for the previous penalty. Where there's a significant difference is on the R factor. And in this particular instance, the department made a finding that the violation was a result of flagrant conduct. And the rationale or the reasoning behind that was because of the prior violation, the department had communicated with the company at that time that this was not a proper way. In fact, it was an illegal way to dispose of their wastes. And then the company, a month later, went and did the same thing. And again, the C factor, the ELS gave them a plus two. So that was, another aggravating factor. I think it was, again, also based on the fact that they had done the same thing a month before. And so the department felt they were uncooperative in their conduct. And then, again, on the EB, again, I think any economic benefit the company might have received was pretty negligible. So in this instance, we did not assess any economic benefit.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Was the hazardous material here chlorine, or what was the problem?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I'm not sure exactly what it was, but it was in fact, for the wash water or for the?
The spa water.
The spa water? I think we're talking about different cases.
Maybe we are. I'm on River House.
We haven't made it to the spa water.
Yeah. River House is next.
Okay. Representative Hayden. All right. Oh, we're still on Bionic Group. Yeah.
We are.
All right.
And again, we take the numbers that come from the various findings the department made, plug it into the formula, and the amount of the penalty for the second violation was $6,600. I believe if you take the two together, the total is
$10,200. Okay. Now to River House.
The factual background of this case, the River House installed a pool, indoor pool, and a spa in 1989, and at that time they connected the overflow and the wastewater from those facilities to a storm sewer that drains to the Deschutes River. The department has estimated that approximately 27,000 gallons of the pool and spa water was being discharged to the river per year. And we also found that the average chlorine residual, the amount of chlorine in this water, was 6.2 milligrams per liter. That's a high level of chlorine, what we usually put in discharge permits for facilities that discharge to public waters is 1 milligram per liter, so it's 6.2 times higher than we would permit anybody to put in. There's also a concern during low flow periods in the Deschutes when it doesn't have as much assimilative capacity. There's an in-stream water quality standard for chlorine which is designed to protect fish. At a certain level, chlorine becomes toxic and will kill fish. And the level in the Deschutes is only 0.019 milligram per liter. So when, again, you're putting water in at 6.2 milligrams per liter, there's a concern that it might have violated the water quality standard for chlorine in the Deschutes. So we assessed a penalty in this case, and that would be the next exhibit, exhibit one with River House on the front. And again, this is the third case. This is another discharge of wastewater to the state without a permit. So it has the same classification as the prior two cases. We made the same determination at regarding magnitude as the prior two cases. So it's a class one moderate magnitude violation. The matrix puts the base penalty at 3,000. No prior significant action, so that factor is a zero. The H factor is also therefore a zero. For the occurrence factor, that was an aggravating factor of two. This was a violation that was ongoing since 1989, so approximately 10 or 11 years of violation. But at the time we discovered it, we chose not to assess individual penalties for multiple occurrences of the violation, just to assess one penalty. And so in this case, because it's ongoing and repeated, there's an aggregating factor of two that's applied. On the R factor, we made another finding, again, a finding in this case of negligence. Again, when they designed the facility, they did knowingly and purposely hook up to the storm sewer. Their other option, in fact, what they have done since is hook up to the City of Bend's sanitary sewer, which the City of Bend treatment plant can handle this wastewater. It was what they should have done initially when they designed and built the facility. So we felt that they knew or should have known that where they were putting their wastewater, where their wastewater was going from this facility, and their failure to do that constituted negligence. So that's an aggravating factor of two. On the C factor, they got the credit of two. The company was cooperative. They did immediately cease discharging to the storm sewer, and they have since, in fact, connected with the sanitary sewer at the City of Bend, so they are no longer discharging to the Deschutes River. In this case, we did assess an economic benefit. There would have been fees. There would have been construction costs associated with connecting to the city sewer. There was also permit fees, other things that they would have had to pay over the course of the 10 or 11 years that this was ongoing. And so this was in the nature of what we would call a cost delayed. You are supposed to spend a certain amount of money at a certain period of time. You don't do that. You have the sort of the time value of money. You can put that money towards other things, make that money work for you during that time. So that's sort of the idea of a cost delayed factor. You do eventually pay the cost at some point, but it's those dollars that you pay today for that compliance cost don't reflect what those dollars were worth when the violation occurred. And we took all that into consideration and came up with an economic benefit in this case of $2,312.
Madam Chair, I want to interject something or have Neil interject it, and we won't get into it today in the interest of time, but you should know there is an elaborate model that is used for calculating economic benefit. And I think it's created by EPA.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So again, we plug all the numbers into the formula, and the final penalty was $5,912. River House has appealed this penalty, and discussions are ongoing on how to resolve the case. The fourth case that we were asked to look at was the case of Mr. Lynn Timmerman in Umatilla County. And this is a complicated case, and it brings in a couple of different issues, so I'm going to take some time to give some background on this. The vast majority of the department's penalties are assessed under ORS 468-130 and then our rules, Division 12, Section 45, which limits penalties to $10,000 per day. The department does have alternative authority to assess higher penalties. In about 1991 or 1992, there was a very severe acid spill in the John Day River, which caused a major fish kill. And at that time, under our penalty authority, we could only assess a penalty of $8,000. And the legislature at that time felt that was grossly inadequate to the harm that was caused. And so they enacted ORS 468.996. And that created what the department refers to as the $100,000 matrix. And what this provides for is that in instances where a violation has been caused by either reckless, intentional, or flagrant conduct, and that violation in turn either creates an imminent likelihood for an extreme hazard to public health, or extensive damage to the environment, we can assess penalties under that matrix. And what it does is it's an alternative way of selecting a base penalty. So what that matrix provides for is that if it's a recklessly caused violation, the base penalty is $50,000. And again, you have to make these other criteria, either the public health hazard or the extreme environmental harm. If it's an intentionally caused violation, it's $75,000. If it's a flagrantly caused violation, it's $100,000. I would like to point out that we got this authority, or the department got this authority in 1993, and there's only been three cases in that time where we have assessed penalties under that matrix. And the third case, the most recent one where we did this, is in fact this case involving Mr. Timmerman. Now, the factual background is that in 1989, Burlington Northern was abandoning railroad tracks in the Hermiston Helix area, and Mr. Timmerman agreed to take all their old railroad ties, and there were thousands of these railroad ties that he took and put on his property. Now, on the day that the violation occurred, witnesses at the Helix School observed Mr. Timmerman moving about the pile, and shortly after he emerged from the pile, they saw smoke coming out of the pile, and then a fire erupted, and that fire eventually consumed the entire tie pile.
It's quite a fire.
Yes, ma'am. These ties were treated with wood preservative. We don't know if it was creosote or if it was copper chrome arsenate. Regardless of the type of preservative, all wood preservatives, or at least these two types of wood preservatives that they use on railroad ties, are very toxic. They have very toxic constituents within them. And so that was an area of a very large concern to us. Another factor that we looked at, in addition to the potential for toxic constituents and the smoke that was generated by the fire, was that immediately downwind of the fire was the Helix School. It's a K-12 school, public school for Helix, Oregon. The smoke went over the school, and they forced the evacuation of the school. A number of the children exposed to the smoke suffered persistent coughing, difficulty in breathing. Adults that were exposed complained of, again, difficulty in breathing, headaches, sore throat, nausea. And another important factor was that at least one of the children we know of was an asthmatic. And at the time we were considering the penalty assess, we consulted with a physician in the area who treats children for respiratory ailments. He's also on the Pendleton Area Air Quality Commission. And he informed us that the chemicals that are in creosote or in copper chrome arsenate can in fact cause respiratory failure in asthmatics, and it can actually cause death if there's not immediate medical intervention. So we took all these factors, all these facts, in deciding that we would assess a penalty under the $100,000 matrix in this particular case. And then, so if we turn again to Exhibit 1, or it's labeled as Exhibit 1 for Mr. Timmerman, the civil penalty, way the penalty is calculated is somewhat different. A lot of the terms are the similar. Again, the base penalty is a consideration of whether or not we've met the extreme environment, or the imminent hazard, no, imminent likelihood of extreme hazard to public health, which is what we felt we had the facts to prove in this case, and whether or not it was intentionally caused, and we also felt that we had sufficient evidence that Mr. Timmerman had lit the fire himself. So that, we take those factors, an intentionally caused violation, and the base penalty is $75,000. Mr. Timmerman did not have a prior significant action. He had, in fact, received a letter. He had been, the department had received a complaint that he had burned prohibited materials before, and that's what a railroad tie would come under the rules, would be a prohibited material. We received a complaint. We wrote him a letter at that time explaining what the rules were, that he could not burn prohibited materials, and left it at that. We only gave him a warning letter, did not assess a penalty. So that type of warning letter is not sufficient to constitute a prior significant action. So that value is zero. On the H factor, again, since the P factor is zero, the H factor is zero. Looking at the O factor, the fire continued, started in the morning, or actually I believe in the afternoon, continued all night well into the next day. So the violation occurred for more than one day. Under the O factor, that results in an aggravating factor of two, pursuant to the rules. On the C factor, we found Mr. Timmerman uncooperative. When our inspector first arrived on the scene, he requested that Mr. Timmerman call the Helix Fire Department to respond to put out the fire, and Mr. Timmerman refused to do so. Eventually, I believe the Hermiston Fire Department did respond. Those are the fire trucks you see in the picture. So it wasn't as if the fire went unintended the whole time, but it was not Mr. Timmerman who asked those fire trucks to be there. It was either our inspector or perhaps folks from the school. I'm not really sure where the call came from, but we do know that when we asked Mr. Timmerman to call fire authorities, he refused to do so. So that was a two-factor. We then looked at the economic benefit of the violation, and we determined it would have been the cost of properly disposing of the railroad ties as opposed to burning them. We had the dimensions of the pile, so we did an estimate of the entire volume of ties that were there, and then talked to the local landfill and said, if somebody brought in this volume of railroad ties, how much would it cost to dispose of them? And the landfill said, well, we could take them, but we couldn't take them all at once. It would take a period of time over to do that. So we took that factor also into consideration. So we figured what a cost would have been for him to dispose of it over the course of 2 years. And that's that value that we came up with, was the $55,699, which I think includes not only the cost of disposal, but also the cost of transporting the ties to the landfill.
Senator.
Ma'am, I have a question.
Yes.
If I might. Was Mr. Timmerman paid for the disposal of these railroad ties?
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, my understanding was that he just agreed to take them. Burlington Northern needed to get rid of them, and he asked. And I'm not sure how they came in contact with him, but my understanding is he did not actually receive money to take them.
Madam Chairman, is it presumed that Burlington Northern had no knowledge of the potential toxic nature of the coatings on these railroad ties?
Senator Farrelly and Madam Chair, I would assume that Burlington Northern knows exactly what's on their railroad ties. But Neil, would you know what the requirements would be for disposing of railroad ties?
I do not know.
No. Madam Chairman, I guess it occurs to me that Burlington Northern knew well what they were doing, and if they found someone willing to take the railroad ties, that probably was an expedient way to get rid of a lot of railroad ties that they would otherwise have to dispose of in a food receptacle or landfill or in a process. And I just wonder if we're not stepping over the issue of whose railroad ties these were originally and looking at the holder in due course who ends up with a $55,000 fine. And I guess if the question really is there any potential for a pass-through liability to the folks that perhaps should have legitimately disposed of the ties to begin with?
Would that be a consideration in a case like this, that there appears to be the basis for looking one step back in the process?
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, I don't think we would have legal recourse under our authority to assess civil penalties to go after Burlington Northern, at least for the burning of the ties themselves. If, for example, this became a cleanup site, and I think that was a large concern that after they burned the ties that some of the wood treating chemicals would still be present, that in fact that ash would be hazardous waste and this could have become a hazardous waste cleanup site. At that point, I think if the department was looking to clean up the site, we would also include Burlington Northern as a potential responsible party. But because the violation itself is the burning of the ties, which Mr. Timmerman did, not Burlington Northern, there isn't no evidence that Burlington rolled up one night with a bunch of trucks and just dumped them there without his knowledge. He did, in fact, agree and accept to take these railroad ties and then held them on his property for some 11, 12 years, and I guess after he found no use for them, decided to burn them.
Representative Hayden.
Well, yeah, that's my question. There was no market. I pay $8 a piece for these things, and we buy them by the semi-truck load. There wasn't enough market to move those things?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, we don't know exactly what Mr. Timmerman's motivation was in accepting the ties. He has communicated to us in our ongoing discussions that, in fact, these were valuable to him and that they were a product, that they weren't waste. That's something we're still sorting out. And as he has, again, as with these other cases, he has appealed this penalty, and we are continuing to discuss with him the resolution of this case. And that's one of the issues that we're going to have to resolve before the department decides finally where it's going to stand vis-a-vis Mr. Timmerman's appeal.
Madam Chair,
could this be an application of the Good Samaritan law? Very often when some Good Samaritan stops to help an individual, they're grateful at first, and then later on somebody gets sued. Maybe he just accepted these out of a good heart with no ulterior motive, and now he's on the hot spot.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I would refer a question like that to the Attorney General. I'm not qualified to answer whether or not a Good Samaritan law would apply here. Certainly, to my knowledge, it's not a defense that Mr. Timmerman has raised to us at this point.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Krieger.
Chair Morgan, from looking at the fire, the thought comes to my mind that perhaps he just likes big fires. And the second thing is that Bonneville Power now is very, very reluctant to let landowners keep the power poles, the wooden poles. They take off the land now because of the liability. They got caught up in a case where they gave it to the farmer. I forgot what the incident was. If someone hit it with a motorbike or something and got hurt, a year or two later, the farmer left it laying right where they'd taken it out, and they ended up getting sued on that and lost. So probably just reasons to wonder.
Senator.
This sounds eerily familiar to a gentleman who had a brilliant plan for recycling used tires. Do you recall the incident and the situation where?
So the senator is referring to RD Mac, or is that another? We have a number of, unfortunately, facilities like that that can work that description.
Where the tires pile up to the size of a barn and suddenly, inexplicably, they burst into flames one day and are consumed. And in a series of coincidences where the same event is repeated, separated by years, you know, where the person actually is paid to take the tires on. Have you ever heard of any circumstances in Oregon?
I can't remember any that we actually...
We've had, Senator Farioli, we've had a number of illegal tire disposal sites, lots of them, but I can't recall right now one of the piles being torched. That might have been before my time.
Okay. Madam Chairman, you know, maybe we, at some point in public policy, ought to look at circumstances, because it may be impossible to find out who the individual owner of tires is. But I don't think it was impossible to figure out who dumped all those ties. And if I can find a landowner gullible enough to convince that he ought to take my hazardous waste tires, whatever, because he sees some value in them, gold amalgam. You know, there's people that will go to dentist's office and ask for mercury from dentist fillings, and they'll reprocess the gold and silver out of the amalgam. And what happens to the mercury? I don't know. But you wonder about the folks that originate this stuff and are under obligation to recycle it. You know, I've seen folks that have one-hour photo processing operations, and you can see the chemicals have spilled and overflowed on the floor. And you know, they're supposed to dispose of those things in approved receptacles. And I'm just wondering, at some point in time, I think the railroad knew very well that, you know, there may or may not be a use for these tires, but giving them to a farmer in the quantities that are indicated by the size of this fire seems to me just to be finding some guy that was willing to hold the bag. So, I don't know. Doesn't look like a good thing to me. Yeah.
We find again Mr. Timmerman on the last case that you brought forward. Can you just, we only have like 7 minutes here, but so if you could just kind of step us through.
Yes, Madam Chair. If I could just make one quick comment about the penalty that was actually assessed. When we ran all the factors and included the economic benefit, the total was $155,699. However, we are limited by statute and rule to $100,000 a day, which is, in fact, the penalty that was assessed. Exhibit 2, we actually, in this particular case, we pleaded in the alternative because we know that proving an imminent likelihood of extreme harm to public health is a very tough burden to meet, and that we may not prevail on that if this case were to go to hearing. So we wanted the hearing officer, if that happened, to have a fallback position that if he or she didn't feel that we met our burden of proving that extreme or imminent likelihood of extreme harm, to calculate a penalty based on our regular matrix, the $10,000 matrix. And that's what Exhibit 2 is.
Okay, so it's for the same occurrence, it's just figured in a different way.
That's correct.
Well, one thing I've learned today, I think that our attendance penalty matrix is way too simple.
Or what?
Well, you'll find out.
I would also, in concurrence with Representative Nolan's request, be interested in taking a look at some of the MOAs that you have, or MAOs, for the small rural towns, for the very point that is raised by Representative Nolan, to compare them to the one that Portland has.
Madam Chair, would you just like us to bring in a couple of examples for you to look at?
And we did a real dismal job of covering our agenda today.
Madam Chair, I do think if we have time on Thursday with you that we can catch up and do those other two items that were scheduled for today in addition to the ones that are already scheduled on Thursday.
We'll have to give it a shot.
Okay.
Anyone in closing have any comments or announcements? No? With that,
did you bring everyone's attention to the memorandum you put out?
Several times.
We will then adjourn this meeting and reconvene at 1 o'clock tomorrow.